real world. They deal with parameters like voltage, current, temperature, light, and all these parameters that we run into all the time, these are analog parameters. Digital circuit deals with information. It's parameterless. It can be ones and zeros, which are math. They can be high and low levels in a circuit. But a digital circuit deals with information content and manipulates the information content. We're talking about power circuits here and how they manipulate power. So for a power circuit, an analog power circuit operates on the parameters themselves, the voltage, the current, and provides the regulation. A digital power circuit operates digitally, and it may operate as control, it may operate as supervision. The power market, at least for IC chips, is a $1 billion market, and a multi-billion dollar market. And for the power supplies themselves, it's even larger. But from an IC viewpoint, there's a couple of different ways we can break down some of the market. We can talk about power controllers. These are chips that actually do the control function of the power. They've got the reference, they've got the control circuitry, and they've got some kind of driving mechanism to drive a power device that actually does the power manipulation. But all the circuitry for the control of the power is in the control chip. And these chips are typically used for systems where you've got a large amount of power that's being regulated or controlled, because it's very difficult and very expensive to add the power devices onto the IC chip. The other kind of chip is a power regulator. And the power regulator itself is a chip which has the control circuitry, and it has a power device that does the power control all on the same chip. These devices are typically lower power devices, and the devices that you'll see in PDAs, in notebooks, in cell phones, in portable equipment. And at that time, it's economic to include the power device on the chip. Typically, if the power device would be very much bigger than the control circuitry, it's not economic to put the power device on the chip. Plus, the process limitations limit the ability of the chip itself to control power. One other area of chips is very high frequency switching regulators. By making the frequency very high, the switching regulator becomes very tiny. This is really important for the small portable pieces of equipment. But the physics of running at very high frequency requires very tiny spacing between the power device and the circuitry that drives it. This relegates these very high frequency switching regulators into the realm of a power regulator where the power device is on the chip. And we won't see very high switching regulators with the power devices spread out over a large PC board. Linear specializes in power devices. We have both the control and the power regulators, and all of our devices are in the analog area, although we do have some investigations going on in digital power control. The very high frequency switching regulators can be made tiny. For example, we have a device that's in what's called an SC70 package, which is about the size of the head of a pin. And this can control over a 1-amp current. And, of course, to make a switching regulator in that size, the circuitry must be simple. It must be able to be put onto a very small chip. and it can't have a lot of transistors. High-performance analog circuits are needed to get high-power, high-performance analog regulators. We have many processes that we use for the development of high-performance analog regulators. These processes allow the chips themselves to operate over a wide input voltage range and provide a constant output. And different parameters on the chip allow us to make them high efficiency, wide range of control, able to withstand reverse battery protection. All kinds of different parameters require different processes for these analog IC chips. And to design them requires experienced analog IC designers who know the circuit design, the control loops involved, the silicon, the applications, and how to put them down on a PC board. So getting high-performance analog ICs to control power is a combination of process and design and experience. But all of these circuits have one thing in common. They're very simple in terms of the number of transistors. Considering the number of transistors that are in microprocessors these days, all of these circuits have countable number of transistors. The other thing about analog power control, it's got a long history in development. So there's a lot of history on what works, what doesn't work, what can get into problems later. And we work on the theory of minimum phone calls, because if you put out a million chips that don't work, you get a million phone calls. When people talk about digital or digital IC control, most of the time the hype in the news is about using a digital circuit to control the power. And using a digital circuit to control the power means that digital circuit has to take the analog world, convert it to digital, compute on it, then come back into analog to operate again. And these chips are transistor intensive. It takes lots of transistors to make a computer, and that's what these chips do. And they compute what it takes to regulate the voltage. But there's some drawbacks to this. It takes lots of transistors, so to make lots of transistors, you want to use a fine line digital process like they use on the microprocessors. The finer the line the process, the more transistors you can put into a chip, the more transistors that you can fit into that chip, the smaller it is, and the lower the cost of the chip. But on the other hand, when you use these fine line processes, the development cost gets very high. Just the mask set for a fine line process is $1 million. So the development cost on a digital IC that requires very fine lines is expensive. The other thing is that the digital chips require a fixed operating voltage. So you've got to have a regulator to regulate the voltage for the regulator. But when you put things into the digital domain, you do have some advantages. When it's operating digitally, assuming the analog sections are identical, all the chips come out identical. So they're going to operate very much identically. And you also can have the ability to program them on the fly to change their characteristics. Why is digital now getting all this press? It's because it's new. It's not been widely accepted yet. There aren't very many products on the market that are digital. So it's getting lots of press. The other thing that happens with digital circuits is that these circuits are being driven by engineering people. And the engineering people, like most engineering people, like to work with the newest, highest, wizziest technology. So the development of digital IC power control may not be driven economically, but may be driven by egos and engineers. So that hasn't been taken out yet. But what does look like it's a good function to implement is a combination of digital and analog. Analog control, digital circuitry for supervision, for programming, for monitoring, for alarm. Many of the Pentiums require variable voltage to operate at their max speed. And by having a programmable power supply, you can control the microprocessor to operate optimally. And with these bigger boards that we've got coming on big telecom systems, having smart, controllable power supplies is almost a must now. But in terms of the control circuit for the voltage, it's not here yet that the digital control is the right way to go. I'm reminded of a quote from a chief technology officer of a semiconductor company that's no longer around, and that was, the customers don't know how hard this stuff is to do. Well, the customers don't care. They just want to get the job done. And the parts that provide a highly efficient functional solution. And when I say that, I mean good function, good performance, best cost ratio are the ones that are going to win in the end. Thank you.
Please welcome Steve Goldman, CEO and Chairman, Power One, Inc.
Everybody. I'm just going to jump right into the digital. I first would like to thank Robert for an excellent job on the clarification of analog versus digital. And one of the points that I'd like to make is that on all of our digital conversion chips that we use, we have a device called an A to D. It's an analog to digital converter. But just as Robert mentioned, the real world is analog. But what's unique about our solution, once we convert that analog voltage to digital, everything else is done in the digital domain. So, does anyone remember what the acronym is for DVD? Well, of course, Digital Versatile Disc. I guess everyone remembers that. And just like the world of analog VHS changed dramatically to DVD, the power world is starting to feel the effects of the digital revolution. Who today has an analog cell phone? Just a few years ago, they were all analog, and now they're all digital, doing all kinds of things like photographs and everything else on the cell phone. So do we really think power is different than every other kind of electronic, high-definition television, digital cameras, TiVo, music? And just like the examples mentioned, fundamentally, digital has incredibly expanded the functionality. So where will the industry go for new designs? When cost is less and functionality is greater, will it be digital or analog? Why this digital revolution in power, should you ask? Well, if you live in California or almost any city, you know the note for real estate is location, location, location. And now the electronics market, after many, many years, is now hitting maturity. And the word in electronics is cost, cost, cost. As technology matures, everything continues to go around cost. Time to market cost, board space cost, component cost, production cost, test cost, R&D cost. And really, increased functionality at a lower cost, digital is less costly than analog for medium and complex systems. And I'll talk more about that as we move along. Let's take R&D cost, for example. With digital technology, engineers can design power modules in maybe 10% of the time with 90% fewer components. And again, here we're talking about medium, and higher complexity systems. Advent Digital can save about 50% of the circuit board real estate, and changes can be made very quickly, on the fly, and programmable. Board-level analog solutions become very complex, difficult, and costly with increasing power management functions, such as lower voltages, turn-on, turn-off sequencing, monitoring, measuring, controlling. And digital power management and conversion can save significant costs for these systems. Another interesting angle, what makes digital power even more practical is that engineering schools today really only emphasize digital. We're creating very few new analog engineers. And with digital power, even non-power design engineers can set up and configure their system very easy using graphical interfaces, Windows-like systems, and things like programming can be done very, very cost-effectively. So customer system engineers can now handle more workload with fewer engineers. The world of analog is typically one wire per one function. So if you have 30 power management functions, very often you'll have 30 wires, a lot of interface, a lot of complicated circuitry. In the digital world, it's done through software and very often high-speed buses or just digital lines that can move a huge amount of data. So our customers benefit with lower costs. Customers are very quickly discovering the cost and system benefits of digital power. They can design and emulate their systems without costly and time-consuming re-engineering and re-layout and retesting of their circuit board. With a truly digital power system, if changes are needed, real-time monitoring of voltages, currents, and even temperatures, it can offer total control and power to delivery of that system. And digital power is an elegantly simple solution for many medium to complex systems, and they really can get added functionality at a very, very low cost. So why are we even discussing digital power? Well, customers want more. Systems are getting more and more complex. On the power management side, our customers want fault management, thermal management, optimization. They want to measure and control everything. And with what we talked about this morning about high oil prices, efficiency optimization. All can be done very easily in digital area. And then at the same time, line widths of semiconductors are getting narrower and narrower, and the voltages are getting smaller and smaller, and the currents are increasing. So you take the combination of complicated management, high currents, and low voltages, it's getting to be very difficult and challenging on these medium and high complexity systems to do it in traditional analog fashion. Some little comparisons of digital versus analog, and here we're talking about board-level solutions on a circuit board. Analog are typically hard wires, many ICs, many passive components. Every function adds cost. As you add more and more functionality, you add more chips or more complicated chips with multi-function. The functionality is always limited to certain controls in the analog area, and each function adds complexity. Now, there's some benefits to analog. It's very proven over time and very cost-effective for low-end and simple systems. On the digital world, everything is soft-wired, very few parts. Things are done through a graphical user interface. Many functions are inherently free. One of the things that Robert mentioned is, you know, digital adds a lot of transistors. That's true, but it does it at very narrow line widths. So on that head of a pin, you can probably fit 50 or 100,000 transistors. Virtually all power management functions, again, once you go digital, you can have the full suite of functionality. You can have on-the-fly changes, dynamic tuning, data storage, and ultimately higher reliability because digital is a more repeatable process. Now, we're not saying that analog is dead. Many applications exist today and will continue to exist for numerous years for analog devices. Consumer devices, many automotive devices, handheld devices, battery chargers, linear and switching regulators, single voltage applications, and low-level power management. So analog will be here for a long time. This is just a simple comparison, again, on more complicated systems, various functions like full monitoring, frequency synchronization. I don't want to get into all the technical jargon, but the gist of this is, in the analog, many of these functions are difficult or very impractical. Once you go into the digital domain, they become very easy. So analog is kind of a gloomy reality of a system designer's life. No complete solution. If in the analog world, multiple third-party components are required, capacitors, resistors, ICs, separate components required for power conversion, power management, and power monitoring. Proliferation of DC to DC converters due to the high number of voltages on the system board. The number of components in a system has increased significantly, and off-the-shelf converters very often need to be tailored and tweaked for individual applications. On the bright side, with digital, the KISS principle, it could be very simple for the designer. Analog is hardwired, digital is softwired. Only two unique parts or very few unique parts can be done in a system. Reduce board space, improve system performance, reduce design and troubleshooting time, and increase functionality at virtually all the power management functions can be done at the same cost. So really, digital power management capabilities from A to Z for board level solutions. Simple management can use what we call a no bus system that we recently introduced that basically has no bus. It's just what we call pin-strapped or hardwired digital implementation. And many customers don't need a lot of fancy functions. They just want two or three regulators, and they want to communicate between those regulators. That could be done with what we call a no-bus system. I'll skip some of these charts. You guys can look at it later on. I did want to address this concept of PM bus or Z. I want to make it very clear that in any industry, multiple standards always exist. First, our Z system is a complete solution with hardware, software, a graphical user interface, and 11 products in production, where the PM bus is a protocol. The PM bus suffers from several limitations, even as this protocol is developed and hardware comes out. And I just want to talk about some of the limitations of PM bus. First, and probably... But PM bus, I don't even know what the word stands for. What PM bus really is, it's something called SM bus, which has been around for many, many years, and it's an additional wire to what's called the SM bus. That's just one of those single, multiple wire buses. It's think of it like USB, but maybe simpler. Power management bus is what it stands for? Okay. So one of the limitations of the PM bus is the customer system's resources are burdened by the requirement of processing power management instructions to the PM bus pole. In our system, we have a digital power manager. All the poles are connected to this manager, and it manages all the power management needs. In the PM bus architecture, if there are 10 poles on a board, all of that digital information to manage those poles has to be done by the host system. Poles are point of load regulators. All right. So one of the challenges would be the customer system firmware would actually have to hold the power management information. And if the power management changed, the customer would have to change their firmware, which is not something they'd like to do. There's also an inability to simultaneously communicate with multiple poles in the PM bus architecture, only one communication per pole. No switching frequency synchronization, and really lower reliability because inherent in the PM bus architecture, non-volatile memory has to be placed on every point of load regulator or DC to DC converter that generates a lot of heat, and memory doesn't like heat. In our system, there's no memory on our point of load regulators. The memory resides on a digital power manager, which is a 100% digital item, which often sits a long distance away. So in conclusion, innovation can't be stopped. Digital will bite into the power market. PowerOne's disruptive technology helps start the change. We've licensed products to our alliance partners, and others are joining. I'd just like to kind of read a couple of quotes from the Gilder Technology Report this September. Power One understood the trend early on and has become the first power supply company to take full advantage of the Moore's Law advances to develop what today remains the only complete digital power system, including both the control and the management function. Next, the competition, which amid brash dismissals of the technology, is engaged in a panicky drive to duplicate it. And third, the question is not whether Moore's Law advances will accelerate digital power into a revolution, but when. Crucial in the light of the headwinds now resisting Power One, resisting Power One Z1. Power One is already there to meet it. You should be there with them. Thank you.
Please welcome to the stage Peter Henry, Vice President, Portable Power.
All right, thank you. I am Peter Henry with National Semiconductor, and I'm not here to preach the gospel of analog or digital. The job of power management in a portable device is very simple. We take energy from a power source, convert it into the energy that's required to drive various signal processing circuits in that portable device. But Steve, when he was discussing the proliferation of digital and the trend from analog to digital of all of our world, neglected to mention was a digital handset today actually contains more analog components and higher precision analog components than an analog handset when it was introduced. The information is digital information. Digital is great for handling information control, programmability, programmable sequences, but it does not handle a lot of the real-world interface. As Bob said, all of the parameters that we interact with, that energy that actually comes out of the battery and has to be converted into the energy necessary to power that processor, or power a baseband, power a radio module, is analog energy. So let's look at what is digital power. We talked a little bit previously about some of the types of digital power. First of all, digital control of power. Bob mentioned this is a need right now, where there's more supervision of the analog circuits, the ability to control power on sequencing. A modern handset has anywhere between 10 and 30 different power regulators in that tiny handset. It's a tremendous number of different power supplies that have to be maintained, turned on in the right order, turned off to ensure that your battery lasts a long time. And the complexity of dealing with that is getting worse and worse. Used to be all of those would be hardwired state machines. More and more that is being handled by programmable power systems. But let's not stop there. Companies are really driving, how do you take that digital capability and replace some of the analog signal chain? Some of the activities of a switching regulator are information control. The feedback of what is the right voltage to put out is information of a kind. Digital is kind of the job of figuring out how to take 1,000 transistors and do the job that we used to do with one transistor. So we took that and, actually, let's go back one slide. And have driven a number of different approaches on making a regulator that has a combination of both analog and digital functions. And then finally, one other and what I consider the most interesting aspect of digital power is actually recognizing that a tremendous number of the regulators in the system are dedicated to driving digital processors. The digital processor fundamentally doesn't care what voltage you're driving it at. All it cares is does it have the sufficient power source to be able to handle its information processing requirements at the clock speed that it's driven at. And so replacing a tremendous amount of the work that we've done to precisely control voltages, to replace it with precisely controlling timing on a digital circuit, is what I'd consider the most explosive, fascinating area of application that brings the best user benefits for power. Let's move on to the next slide. When we talk about digital control of power, this is something that's been done in higher powered systems for quite a while, combining a microcontroller with a number of different regulators. As Steve said, it's often a very difficult system because that controller may have to control several different regulators across the system. In portable devices, you don't have the space. We're trying to shove a PC into your pocket. We actually have done that in many cases. This is an example of an IC that is in production right now and is in several handsets that people probably have in this room, which takes a very high-function power management IC, which has approximately 20 different regulators on board that IC, including switching regulators, linear regulators, charging functions, and other monitoring functions for the handset, and puts a microcontroller on top of that analog power management die to control all of those functions, to provide charging features, change the state machine for different models of handsets, and to control the sequencing of all of those devices. As we said earlier, process is a big issue. The digital processes allow the migration down Moore's Law, figuring out more and more transistors, but they are expensive mass sets. The analog processes are very well optimized for handling the higher voltage power requirements or the precision requirements. And if you try to put all of this onto a single process, such as has happened with some companies, you get to a very expensive process, takes a long time to go through manufacturing, and typically has lower yields. Digital processes are very optimized for digital circuits. Analog processes tend to be very optimized for analog. And by far the best way to handle that is to have separate ICs that utilize the best processes for the task. Board space, however, is always at a premium. So the stacked die approach, combining different process technologies, is the best solution to combining the analog and digital world. Now, if we look at replacing those analog regulators and utilizing the power of digital, we start saying, okay, what in an analog regulator could be changed? Well, some of the issues in analog regulators are that they do have to be tuned to specific inductors. There's a lot of tuning for a specific circuit. That's not necessarily a problem when you're a cell phone manufacturer that's going to produce 250 million handsets in a year, because you want to invest that engineering time to make the lowest cost, best tuned solution. But in other solutions, you may want to have the ability to get to market faster. So what can be replaced with digital? The feedback loop can be replaced. And National Semiconductor has worked with a number of universities, and we've developed several different pieces of silicon which change some of the feedback loop from analog domain into digital domain, using novel architectures for the analog to digital converter, putting in a digital PID controller, which is a proportional integral differential controller, and that predicts, that tells the circuit what you do to control the power devices. These are great, but the net result is that we are using 1,000 transistors to do the job of one analog transistor. And the power used by these devices so far is not comparable to the efficiency that can be obtained through analog means. Analog remains the most efficient, lowest power, highest performance means of controlling the power conversion in the industry. We continue to do the research, and there are companies that have introduced some digital controlled circuits, and there are more companies who claim to have a digital power regulator, but only replace a very small portion of the regulator with a digital loop. Let's move on finally to the best part of the digital process. And again, I mentioned the digital processors, the logic in a circuit, really doesn't care what voltage you deliver. Tremendous amount of the cost and the expense of a system is in producing very high tolerance output voltages to comply with very tight specifications on a processor in order to meet the timing requirements on that processor. Well, the simple solution is to recognize the voltage is unimportant. All that's necessary is that the energy to the processor maintains the prop delay on the gates in the right section of that processor. The National Semiconductor and ARM have been working together for several years to develop what we call the PowerWise technology, which actually measures the timing of indexes on the digital processor IC and works with a regulator to replace that voltage feedback loop with a feedback loop that maintains the minimum necessary energy delivery to a processor to maintain the prop delay on the processor. That allows a tremendous reduction in energy consumption, and this is one of the true value points that you see possible with the application of intelligent digital processing to the power solution. Just replacing digital and an analog regulator doesn't change the efficiency of the regulator. You have a 95% efficiency analog regulator, a 95% efficient digital regulator, but changing the system load requirements and how it interacts with the regulator can have a dramatic reduction on the total power used by the system. And the PowerWise technology has been shown to reduce the energy usage anywhere from 30% down to more than 80% reduction in power for processors. So let's just take a quick summary. Why do we care about digital? Digital potentially has reduced development time by programmability of it, by the possibility of reusing more of the components and not having to tune the analog circuits. You can potentially reduce the development time of systems. The compensator design of a digitally controlled regulator may also make life a little bit easier and reduce the need for skilled and trained analog power engineers. And by using some intelligence in the PID filter of a switching regulator, there's the possibility that you could even adapt to the needs of different passive components or layouts of a board. Potentially, digital gives you more portability. But most of these remain potential promises. Improved performance and lower cost is really the only thing that the customers care about and the only thing that is necessary. National Semiconductor is the largest market share owner of power management components in the world, and we outgrow the market regularly in portable devices. And we do that by recognizing that our job is simply energy conversion from the battery to the load, and that's it. It's a black box. It's performance and cost, and people don't care how we get there. By delivering the right performance using combination of analog and digital to get to the lowest cost so that a 250 million unit handset manufacturer can afford to use these components, can afford to produce handsets that will penetrate developing countries in India and China, is a tremendous task. And it's identifying what is the right combination, where can we add value, where can we improve the performance of the devices, and using the right process, the right technology, not worrying about whether it's digital or analog, but focusing on the end requirements. Thank you.
You mentioned something that I'd like to you to expand on. You said that digital control is not here yet. I was interested in yet, and also the fact that you were mentioning control as opposed to management. And if we could just back up a minute, we heard the audience has heard control, digital control, digital management, the feedback loop. If we could have a brief explanation as to what the difference is between these terms, and then go into the fact that the digital that control the control loop, as I understand it, is much it's harder to do digitally than management, which has been digital management has been something that's been coming on for a number of years.
Okay, let me first, I guess, define the term. When I use the word digital management, that's the use of a digital word, digital information, to turn the regulators on and off, to control their output voltage, to get information back from them, to when there's multiple regulators, to sequence them properly, all under some information control that's coming along some digital bus or some digital IC. And that's the digital management of it. Digital control is the loop, the control loop, that gives the regulated output voltage. If a regulator, the input voltage goes up, the control circuit has to make some modifications as to what it's doing so the output doesn't go up simultaneously. And that's the control loop. Okay, feedback is the mechanism, whether it's digital or analog, that is used to control the output voltage. There's some voltage internal to the chip that's the reference. There's some voltage that's supplied to the chip that's the output. And internally, the chip compares what the output is to what it should be and makes changes in the control loop in either the switching pulse width or some other parameter to keep the output regulated. And in terms of digital management, that is a problem. That's a real problem. And there's real solutions now with digital management chips on the market and them built into many of the ICs. And when I say the digital control loop is not here yet, the majority of IC regulators on the marketplace now are all analog. And yes, there are a few that use a control loop that's digital, but it's not a major force yet.
Steve, would you say that it's the major advance that Power One has made is in digitizing the control loop? And gave a few quotes from our September report. And I don't know if this quote was in there, but one I got in my research was that the point is that today, if you digitize everything, you not only add cost, we heard a lot about cost, but you can also limit what you can do digitally versus analog. And the comment was that, the example was that you could limit the current you can drive into the control switches, which I guess is getting back to the control loop. So do you have a comment on the fact that perhaps by going digital at this point, you're actually limiting what you can do as opposed to analog?
Actually, we're not limited at all. In fact, we have far more capability. And Power One took the solution of digital power management and looked at it a little differently. As both of the speakers have identified, there's two worlds. There's the management world and the conversion world. We determined that in order to solve the power management problem, you have to turn to digital control. You have to take the analog control loop and make it digital. In our solution, we have one analog to digital converter, because the real world is analog, and then we do everything in the digital domain. You have a digital control loop. We have far more capability. The limitation is the number of bits you have on the analog to digital converter. That's the only limitation.
Could you expand on that?
An analog digital converter basically takes an analog signal and digitizes it. And whether you're using 8 bits, 12 bits, 16 bits, the more bits you have, the higher the resolution. And somewhere between 10 and 12 bits is more than enough resolution that any customer would need in the application.
I know there are a lot of our subscribers that are interested in Power One that I'd like to go out and see if there are any questions in the audience. But I have, I think the overall comment, as I see it, that I could make is that we're having sort of a race here between Moore's law and analog, maybe a contest like Andy Kessler was talking about last night. And 10 years ago, we wouldn't be up here talking about digital control, certainly, and probably not much about digital management. And today we are. It's true that the end customer doesn't care whether it's digital or analog, but he cares about the functionality, and so you folks care about whether it's digital or analog. And so the main question is, who's going to win this race? Is Moore's law going to eventually, in an exponential curve, at some point just swamp and overwhelm the capability of analog?
Let me give you another point of reference to throw some numbers out. We could control a 1,000-watt power system, all the functionality, for a few dollars. We're not talking about $50. We're talking about single-digit number of dollars to control, reverse, manage the entire system. So it's very, very inexpensive. Some of our chips and volume will be eventually at the market at sub $1. Control a telecommunications
system. Now, an interesting point to me that Bob raised and you mentioned is the depletion of the analog mind, as I call it. I mean, obviously, all electronics ultimately is founded on analog capabilities. And it's an asset for you that you can deal with the digital designers who are pouring out of our universities to probably an inadequate extent. But, Bob, tell me what you think. Where are you hiring analog designers for your jobs? And where are you hiring yours at National Semiconductor? All these are our favorite companies here, and I just am interested in whether there's a crisis in finding the analog capabilities that you need.
Well, I give talks at some of the schools around the U.S., and 5 years ago, the talks were not very well attended, and everybody wanted to be an internet startup. And lately, the students see that analog companies do well. Analog technology is a needed commodity in the industry. And ever since I started in this industry in 1969, the analog content of the semiconductor industry has been about 20% of the total semiconductors sold. And it hasn't changed over 35, 36 years. It's still 20% as the semiconductors grow. So the schools are seeing that analog is an increasingly important area, and it's increasingly easy for students to get jobs in that area. So they are training there. We grow a lot of our own. And we've been able to keep up.
How about when you go to China or India, these other countries, do you find the same depletion of the analog mind over there, or do you find that they are focusing on analog, or do we have an asset here in our analog companies?
I think we have an asset in the U.S., especially the way that we think about it. I find that Singapore has also caught on to the idea that analog is a good idea. Japan has some. I'm not real familiar with China, but I haven't seen a lot out of there.
Did they buy a lot of stuff from you?
Yeah, we sell over 50% of our output goes outside the U.S. There's a lot to China, Japan, and Asia.
In terms of looking for analog talent, it's true that there was a time period when the universities really were cranking out digital engineers. And as Bob said, that trend has changed dramatically. And it's driven by real simple things like the requirements for analog in modern electronics are far more rigorous and more difficult than ever before. The communication chips, the radio chips, the modulation of the signal to enable the broadband access that we have is all analog. And that requires highly skilled analog engineers. Power management is one of the fastest growing and most profitable segments of the industry, largely driven by the need for much more efficient solutions than ever before. So the demand is there, and of course people will rise to the demand. That's happened in the U.S. It's also happening very dramatically overseas. We have a crisis in the U.S. We don't have a crisis, but we do have a strong recognition of the power of analog circuitry throughout the rest of the world. My group alone operates 15 design centers worldwide, including places like Estonia, where we have an excellent relationship with the university that cranks out outstanding analog engineers. We're seeing in China a tremendous focus on analog engineering in some of the key universities. And those universities alone will crank out 10 times the number of analog engineers that any of the U.S. Universities have.
Are they good?
Well, they're new.
Right.
And as Bob will say, a big part of a skilled analog engineer is really an apprenticeship type time, understanding how to design analog, because a lot of it is experience. And in China, the experience is lacking. They're smart, they're intelligent, they know what they want to do, but they don't have that access to the strong mentors that we do have here in the U.S. But that's changing as people head back to China, start companies, and to a certain extent, sheer enthusiasm will make up for experience.
I consider designing analog circuits similar to learning a language. You get out of school, and you've got the basics of it, and you get the circuit in front of you and start reading equations as to what this part does and what this part does, what that part does. And that's like doing a translation. You get some foreign piece of literature, and you start looking up the words one by one, and eventually you find out what it says, and eventually you find out how the circuit works. But until that language is part of you and you really know it, you're not going to write poetry in it. And doing an experienced analog engineer can take a schematic of lots of parts and look at it, and in 2 minutes he knows what it's doing.
Who makes your A to Ds?
We do.
You do. You
make. And one of the things I'd like to mention is that in order to develop our digital system, we put our smartest analog engineers on the job.
Right.
Because that's what we need. A combination of people doing analog, a little bit of digital, and power. So I agree with a lot of the comments. You must have a keen understanding of analog.
Right.
The world will always have a blend of analog and digital. The difference with us, we have a small amount of analog and a large amount of digital.
Did you, which part of your company makes the A to Ds? Did you purchase that capability or did you develop that?
Develop it on our own.
It is.
We use foundries that have standard cells that you can have IP blocks available. You don't really have to complete.
I've got a question, if I may, to Steve. From your, from the perspective of intellectual property on your digital management, to what extent do you perceive that as a barrier to entry if Power One is correct in your assumptions that you this will really be a major breakthrough going forward?
We really like to win at business, succeed at customers based on the merits of the product. And IP is part of everyone's portfolio, and everyone has IP, but we believe that we'll win at customers and are winning at customers based on the cost effectiveness and the functionality of our service.
Doug Lockett with Gigabeam. As you go to this digital miniaturize and stick it on chip, two things. Number one, miniaturizing, stick it on chip, does that create more noise problems? And number two, are you actively canceling the noise with digital systems?
In dealing with digital, there is always noise issues, and it's something that has to be dealt with, and that's why there's still some analog components, there's some filtering. So it's always something you have to deal with, and you also have to deal with noise in the analog world. So it's just a part of good circuit design practice, whether you're analog or digital.
Well, isn't the noise problem much more serious in the analog world, right? I mean, it's because analog devices are immediately responsive to noise, while there's a threshold in the digital realm that essentially reduces the damage of noise.
And this is in particular to regulators. You've got some low voltages and some voltages you're measuring, and on the other side or near it, you have these power switching devices. They're switching many volts at high speed, generating huge amounts of noise. And that can get into the analog, or in a digital system, it can get into the analog-to-digital converter, which is looking at very small increments of voltage at the same time. So these problems have to be handled, whether it's digital or analog. Once you're into the digital domain and you're working with information, you can reject a lot of that noise.
We have time for one more question.
Missed the second part of my question. It ought to be, I'll say it a different way now, it ought to be possible to cancel the noise or at least minimize it when you got all this richness of digital. So are you doing that?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Exactly. It was just mentioned the same. In the digital world, you have the ability to cancel more of the noise. But really what it comes down to is good circuit implementation. Whether it's analog or digital, the layout of the IC is critical. And if it's a well-done layout, you're going to have less issues than if it's a poorly done layout. Okay, we have a final question.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Glenn Gong. Thanks for taking my question. I just wanted to clear up some apples to oranges kinds of things. Mr. Golden, I think you said that your products are geared primarily for larger circuit boards where you have multiple chips, microprocessors, dual programmable gate arrays, NPUs, et cetera. The mid-end to high-end, would you say, then?
Precisely. The typical application, the cost of a customer circuit board would typically be between $250 and $15,000. So these are optical switches, networking equipment, storage devices, not handheld devices.
Okay. The key, as I understand it, is power is predominantly analog, and your technology then takes that power, turns it on and off through pulse modulation, if you will, turns it on and off, so that you can have the required voltage. Everything else, however, is on the digital side. Is that correct?
Yeah. In our system, the difference between our system, very simply, is most of what's out in the world today is analog power conversion to some digital control. Our system is digital conversion and digital control. We only have one analog to digital converter. Go to the real world. So we're doing essentially 98% of the work in the digital domain versus the rest of the universe is probably more of a 50-50. That's the fundamental difference. Yes.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
History of Bob's company and his early career in Microcosm. Bob was one of the heroes of Microcosm and led me through the whole analog domain. And Bob Weidler, he had all these stories. It's really, he contributed a major amount to my first book on this technology. Well, thank you. They are. I mean, this is one of the great companies in the history of Silicon Valley that Bob largely built up. And Paul McWilliams is an expert on this field and on linear technology and all these, and believes that the heyday of the semiconductor industry is just beginning. So, Paul McWilliams.
All right. I think these guys were speaking English. I'm going to try to speak English for investors. I'll confuse things a little bit. Talk about economics in English and economics of semiconductors. George, I want to thank you for inviting me to the 9th annual meeting for unreasonable people. George Bernard Shaw said, Reasonable people try to adapt themselves to the world. Unreasonable people try to adapt the world to themselves. Therefore, all progress is made by unreasonable people. I like being a member of that club. We're going to talk a little bit about semiconductor cycles, and I think these things are intimidating for most investors. Well, they should be. They're volatile. At least they have been, and they may not be quite so much in the future. But to understand semiconductor cycles, we need to first understand a little bit of the history of what's going on. Why the data you normally read about semiconductors might be misleading you. What drives semiconductor cycle? Why some semiconductor sectors move independently of the broad cycle? Now, this is going to surprise you. What recent changes in supply and demand dynamics are going to affect semiconductor cycles going forward and how they're going to affect those cycles? Why a slower rate of revenue growth is not necessarily bad news for us investors. So the best way to predict the future is to understand the past. So let's take a look at that. Willie Sutton said, Willie Sutton said the reason he robs banks is because that's where the money is. In the world of semiconductors, the money is in ICs. As you can see here, 84% of the revenue for all semiconductors is ICs, yet only 24% of the volume. Every other non-IC semiconductor makes up 16% of the revenue, but 76% of the volume. So as you might imagine, a small change in discretes, which make up 66% of the volume, is going to affect the way you think about semiconductors if you're trying to equate, or the way you're going to think about integrated circuits if you're going to try to equate volume and revenue. And the problems that exist here are just that. The problems here is a lot of these smaller companies in Asia are non-reporting companies to the SIA, Semiconductor Industry Association. If they don't report, the SIA has to estimate the data. And what we're seeing here is these Asian companies feed off the bottom of the food chain. And when they feed off the bottom of that food chain, they're getting all these cheap, high-volume parts. So more and more is being estimated in the data that you're looking at. So what we're going to do today is talk only about ICs. So if some of the numbers don't quite match up with what your recollection is of historic data, remember, I'm just going to focus on ICs today. The semiconductor business model is one of very, very high fixed costs and relatively low variable costs. That means if there's an unfavorable balance of supply and demand, in other words, there's more supply than there is demand, you've got to keep that factory running. You've got to fill that factory somehow, and the way you do that is you lower costs. But when all the demand goes down and everybody's lowering costs, you run through this kind of wicked cycle and you end up with a down cycle in semiconductors. Now, unfavorable balances in supply and demand are caused by one of two things, a decline in demand or an increase in supply. And declines in demand happen very infrequently. As a matter of fact, there's only been one significant decline in demand in the history of the transistor. So what we're going to look at here on this chart is the areas where we had cycles. Now, if you could go back to that, please. Okay, where you see the blue line shooting up from below the green line to well above the green line, you had an up cycle. In other words, you didn't have enough capacity to meet demand. Where you see the blue line shooting down below the green line and the red circles here on the bottom, you had too much capacity. That's pretty brutal cycling there, and that's why a lot of investors are scared by semiconductors. Okay, now we'll move up to, there we go. This is the one time that unit volume actually declined. It declined by 21% in 2001. We remember that a lot. A lot. And revenue declined by 33%. But the thing that people wrote about this was caused by a glut of capacity. It really wasn't. Capacity only went up 8% from the very peak usage area of Q3 2000 to the trough of capacity utilization in Q3 2001. What actually happened was wafer starts declined by 28%. So that's the proper way to think about the recession of 2001 in semiconductors. is it was a demand-driven recession. But it's the only one that has been that way since the transistor was developed. So now let's take a look at the other points here where we had a... Did you skip one? There you go. That's the one I needed. There's three other points on this chart where unit demand dropped to very near zero. In other words, a 0% increase over the preceding year. Of ICs. This is strictly ICs.
There would be no...
Up and to the right.
Yeah.
Up and to the right. And we'll get to that in just a minute. You'll love this part, George. But don't spoil my punchline, will you? I actually have a couple of things to say here that are funny, as much of a nerd as I am. You can see the three areas here on this chart, 92, 96, and 98, where year-over-year unit volume was pretty much flat. Let's take a look at these three so we can understand what caused these cycles, and then we'll understand a little bit better what's going to cause the cycles going forward. In 1992, we had a really unusual situation. Unit volume was literally flat. However, revenue went up. And that confused a lot of people. But there was really good reasons for that. Late 1989, Intel released the 486. That was a high-priced part. We also had a whole bunch of military volume with the Gulf War thing. Now, I was selling military semiconductors at the time. And it was great. Let me tell you, those things were very, very expensive. And we also had the leading edge of capacity expansion was going very slowly at that time because Japan was in their recession, so they weren't expanding capacity. Okay, now following this very unusual situation, the IC sector enjoyed the best three-year run in its whole history. Between 1993 and 1995, total IC revenue increased by 152%. This was driven by the convergence of three events. Again, another three thing. The Japanese companies continued to constrict the capacity expansion, and particularly in DRAM. Intel released the Pentium processor, Intel again. And capital spending by U.S. companies, which was driving semiconductor demand at the time, went up 59% from 1992 to 1995. However, as often the case, what really happened can't be seen on this chart. This is all aggregate numbers. So we've got to dig in here a little bit deeper. We'll lift the hood and let's take a look here at the next slide, what really happened in 1993 through 1995. Now, this volatile red line that you're looking at here is DRAM revenue. DRAM revenue went up 379% during these 3 years. So the rest of the revenue went up just a little bit over 100%. Still a great three-year run. Don't take me wrong there. But this run that we were talking about, this 152% run that we were talking about, was DRAM driven. Let me give you an idea about how things were in DRAM at that time. DRAM pricing went from roughly $5.50 and 1992 to just under $20 in December of 1995. Can you imagine that? I mean, I was actually auctioning off DRAMs and saying, well, if you want the DRAMs, you've got to buy this other stuff too. And those were great days for us sales guys. However, the pendulum swung back. The thing that people don't realize, though, and when you look at this, let me skip back for just a second. Step back to that slide a little bit. No, one more up. Thank you. Okay, now this red line is the DRAMs I was talking about. The green line that is actually a little bit faint on here is all semiconductors in total, including the DRAMs. This blue line here that you see is all semiconductors excluding DRAMs. And what a lot of people don't realize that happened in 96, they think there was a semiconductor recession in 1996. There wasn't. There's a DRAM recession in 1996. In 1996, year-over-year sales for all semiconductors, excluding DRAMs, went up 9%. So there was no recession there. The supply glut in DRAMs continued on. And here we go. One more. There we go. The supply glut in DRAMs continued on and went all the way up to 1998. By 1998, DRAM sales had dropped off by $16 billion. In 1995, there were $40 billion. They dropped to $24 billion in 1998. That was just a huge decline in DRAMs, and the prices went down to about 3.25 by then. But in 1998, the supply glut caught up with the industry. The demand and unit volume was flat, and everything went down a little bit. So you can see we actually did have a recession. You can see with the blue line there, even excluding DRAMs, we did have a recession in 1998. There you go. There's 1998. Okay. So let's recap here just real quick what we've learned so far. And that is there's two, in the last 15 years, there's two legitimate recessions in the semiconductor industry. The first one in 1998. Thanks. The first one in 1998 was due to excess supply. The one in 2001 was due to a decline in demand. There was not a broad IC recession in 1996. During any given year, it's common for at least one IC type to move independently from the broad market. As you thought, DRAMs had a recession, ICs did not. Now let's look at the changes in the supply and demand dynamics that are going to change things going forward, and things are really going to change quite a bit. Contract fabs have taken a lot of buffer in this elasticity that we need in moving demand in and out and keeping that fab running at a level to where it's efficient. 85% is about the line where a fab really gets a little bit nervous if they're not fully depreciated, and there are some fully depreciated fabs out there. But a fab that's a fairly new fab, if you're not running it at 85%, you're probably going to be losing money. So when it gets down to 85%, we all get a little bit nervous. And when we saw in Q1, total utilization, as it gets reported, people don't talk about the utilization of semiconductor companies and contract fabricators. They talk full utilization. And that hit 85%, and that got everybody really nervous. What they didn't look at, though, is the contract fabricators were the ones taking the shaft on this. They were down to 75% utilization, where the semiconductor companies, their aggregate utilization maintained at 87%. So what we had here was a really nice buffer, and this buffer is being heavily leveraged by people that use what's called a fab light model. In the fab light model, people share the elasticity of their demand with a contract fabricator. So they'll push a little bit in, a little bit out. If you take a look at, like, analog devices, they aren't here, so I can talk about them. At between 250 and 350 nanometer production rules, they move their products in and out of contract fab or in and out of their internal fab to keep their internal fab loaded properly and efficiently. This helps just tremendously. Now, the other thing that this is doing, having these contract fabs out there, is it's limiting the amount of fab expansion that the other companies need to do, that the semiconductor companies need to do. So when you think semiconductor company, think of the National, think of the Linear Techs, the Analog Devices, the Texas Instruments, the Quick Logics. Think of all these guys out there. These are semiconductor companies. TSMC and UMC over in Taiwan, Chartered in Singapore, those are fabricators. So when I'm talking semiconductor company, I'm talking about one of these manufacturers, fabricators or the other guys. Even TI will see their depreciation go down this year to a level lower than they've seen in 5 years. Yet they're still expanding capacity. They're just doing it a little bit better. Now, in addition to this fab buffer that we're having, we also have supply channels are getting quite a bit shorter, and they're getting more efficient. Inventory has been pushed back in the supply channel, and if you read a report, which I'll give you a link to, and you'll have it sitting on your table after lunch, called State of Tech, you'll see an inventory analysis of seven different sectors in the tech world, and you'll see where that inventory is moving. Semiconductor companies have actually just matured. And what we had was a bunch of engineer cowboys out here in Silicon Valley running this thing. And they weren't running it as businesses. Well, a lot of them weren't. Linear Tech always did. I can say that for sure. But a lot of them didn't run as a business. And now they're running as very good businesses, and they're learning how to adapt their operating costs to changes in demand. So through the fab light models, through better management, through better supply channels, through we're growing operating costs faster at the better companies than we're growing revenue. Now, here's just some of the analog mixed signal companies. I happen to like analog mixed signal. And here's what they did in Q2, actual sequential changes. Intercell at the top of the chart, they grew revenue by 8.6%, but they grew their operating profits, and that's what we all care about, by 27.6%. So 4 out of 5 of these guys are growing their profits faster than they're growing their revenue. They're not all using fab-light models. Some of them have different models. Linear Tech, I believe, does all the fabrication in-house, but it's a bit different model, and it works for them. So while all these changes are good and important, when it comes to selecting investments, the really big change that will drive IC revenue in the future is what finally resulted in the tipping point that happened here in the late 90s. Sometime during the 80s, the release of the DOS PC came out. You're maybe ahead of me, but that's okay. You can leave that out. Go ahead and go to that. In 1981, we had the DOS PC came out. A bunch of productivity software came out. Capital spending overtook military spending for the first time. Now, if you think capital spending is volatile, you should see military budgets go in and out. It drove us crazy from the 60s and the 70s. The military spending was just up and down. Now, capital spending, if you look at this chart, the capital spending is the blue line. Semiconductor revenue is the green line there. You can see how it just traces almost perfectly up through 2001. Capital spending goes up, semiconductor revenue goes up. And then we look at the supply and demand perturbations that we were talking about, and that's what shoots it way up or way down below that capital spending line. But it follows that line nearly perfectly. However, something changed. And it started changing in 1995, actually. The web browser came out. We had all the telecom spending come up. That was the CapEx. But all of a sudden, consumers were empowered. They had that GUI interface from Windows 95. Cell phones got cheaper. Everything got cheaper. But what happened was we had a 75% increase in capital spending between 1995 and 2000. So it put the consumer in the shadow. It put all this consumer spending behind the shadows. And then all of a sudden in 2001, we had a little gap there of capital spending. It crashed. Semiconductor revenue went down tremendously. DRAM revenue went down over 60% that year. And then all of a sudden, the consumer spending came out of the shadows. And so what you can see how this chart correlates all the way up until 2001. With capital spending. But then in 2002, capital spending went down again and semiconductor revenue went up. And that caught a lot of people by surprise. I did some research on this and I can almost point you to the month where this happened. And it was in Q3 2002. And the consumer came alive there. And what happened there is we got flooded with digital cameras, cell phones, DVD players, flat screen TVs. And the iPod, was a big deal. The iPod was really a turning point, and I think if we wanted to pin it on one product, it wasn't what drove the revenue, but it's what made geek chic. People were wearing iPods, and it was cool to wear an iPod. They were wearing them walking down the aisle of the Paris fashion show. However, this isn't a story about fashion or even time and place. This is a story about economics. The economics that Carver Mead, named after Gordon Moore. And what Gordon Moore said and what we all know today is Moore's Law. Moore's Law not only drove the average selling price for DSPs and microprocessors down to record low levels, it facilitated the introduction of low-cost, high-resolution imaging products for digital cameras. And also facilitated a rapid drop in the price of what I like to call the consumer memory, or NAND flash. Remember what I said, that in every cycle, there's at least one product type that moves independent of that cycle? Well, that's what happened in 2001. When IC revenue declined by 33% in 2001, DRAMs fell by over 60%, NAND flash memory actually increased in revenue by 138%, an amazing increase. In total, NAND flash is going to move from 370 million in the year 2000 to over 10 billion this year. It's an amazing increase. But the NAND flash memory is what you use in your digital camera to store all your pictures. It's what you have in your phone to store, or in your MP3 player to store files. It's what's, 4 gigabytes of it now in the Apple iPod Nano. And we actually have a pretty big shortage in NAND flash developing right now. But that's now. They'll go into excess supply sometime soon. So now before you run out and buy your favorite NAND flash company, you might want to take a look at them. This is not private information or inside information I'm sharing you. It's pretty well reflected in the NAND flash prices. So what's going forward, what we need to think about is what's going to affect this cycle. We had CapEx driving the cycle. Before that, we had military driving the cycle. Now we've got consumer driving the cycle. And the cool thing about consumer is consumer spending is less volatile than CapEx spending. So actually, going forward, this is going to buffer the demand side of the cycle. And if we think about how contract fabricators are working with the Fab Lite models, that's going to buffer the supply side of the cycle. That and better business practices. So now let's talk a little bit about transistors, George. I know you like this. In 1971, transistors on an IC, and I'm talking the average cost of a transistor, if you look at all the ICs that were sold, and you divide that out by transistors, you paid about $1 a transistor in 1971. In 1981, the tipping point there, the point where military handed off the CapEx, was driven by microprocessor, it was driven by productivity software, but it's also driven by Moore's Law. You could get now a transistor for a penny or 100 for a buck. And as we near this next tipping point that actually took 7 years or 7 years to happen, in 1995, transistors are 25,000 for a dollar. This year we hit the magical point though. Transistors are now $1 million for a buck. Now that's driven heavily by memory. I got to admit that. Analog transistors haven't gone down in price that much. They've gone down noticeably. But certain transistors get really, really cheap, and NAND memory transistors, NAND flash transistors get extraordinarily cheap. Now, people are worried about, let's go back to the number of transistors. Go back to that one again. This year, I was running some calculations. I got some research from quite a few people, and I combined it because nobody really agreed on the exact number. But this year, we're going to pump out enough transistors to sell everybody on this planet, every man, woman, and child on this planet, 35 million transistors. So, you know, do your share, buy these transistors so my stock goes up. But honest to God, 35 million transistors per human being. Now, the amazing thing about it is what Moore's Law did to that. Okay, Moore's Law made it possible to put these 35 million transistors times all these number of people on 1 square mile of silicon. That's not a lot of silicon. To me, that tells me that there's still a lot of room to grow. As consumer demand increases and Moore's Law marches forward, this number's probably going to double in a couple of years. However, revenue is not going to double because of Moore's Law. Revenue will go up, maybe not, you know, maybe 10%, maybe 20%. I don't know. I think it's going to go up about 6% this year, maybe 8% for ICs. All semiconductors, maybe a little bit less. But the pundits want to point out to us that the growth rate is slowing. Well, sure, it's slowing. It's the law of large numbers. It's going to slow going forward. You know, we're not going to have an 18% CAGR. That's just not going to happen. You can see from this growth curve, it's flattening out. However, what they don't tell you, and what's really, really important, is that the next 100 billion is going to come a lot quicker than the last 100 billion. As we move forward, transistors will continue to get cheaper, faster, consume less power, and designers are going to leverage this. They're going to leverage the cheap and the abundant. They're going to develop new technologies and creative human interfaces. And believe me, it's the creative human interfaces that really drive these things. some people might want to call the iPod a hard disk drive with a start button on it. I think that's going a little overboard. But that's a human interface we can understand, and that's what drives these products. Windows 95 drove products. So all these human interfaces and all this technology, we're going to develop products that only George can imagine now, I guess. I can't imagine everything that's going to be coming out. So this next 100 billion is going to come quicker than the last, and the one after that is going to come quicker than that one. And in these hundreds of billions of dollars, there's going to be great opportunity for us investors. And it's just as simple as that. So you look in that 100 billion, and you find the guy that's going to do something different. And there's a lot of guys out there that are going to do it. We just saw three people up here that are going to leverage this, and they're going to do something different, and they're going to have a contest, and there's going to be some winners. And we're going to find those winners. Right, George?
Right.
All of them. Okay. So semiconductor cycles are still going to happen. They're just going to be a little bit less volatile than they were in the past. They're going to be a little bit less frequent. And if you caught the between the lines what I was talking about in memory here, I don't call this McWilliams' law. The cyclicality and life cycle profit of an IC is going to always be inversely related to the area of chip that is covered by memory. Remember how that memory chart was just volatile all over the place? I don't know if you added up all the profits on DRAMs, if you'd actually have a profit. You might even have a loss in the life cycle of the DRAM. Now, the rate of growth for revenue will slow, but at $100 billion, now I'm going to find a winner or two in that bunch. So, anyway, I breezed through that maybe a little faster than I should have. Maybe not. Is there any questions? Oh, there we go.
Sorry, I must have come in late. Peter Treadway, what are the winners?
Pardon me?
I said I must have come in late. What are the winners?
What is the winner?
You're going to find the winners. Tell us what the winners are.
What? Oh, who will they be or who were they? I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Who will they be?
Well, I kind of like the guy at the top of the chart back there. I think that's going to be my favorite pick, but it's certainly not going to be limited to them. You don't remember the top one up there that grew operating profit by 27.6%? Anybody remember that name? Yes, and the symbol for that is? There you go. That would be a good one. There's a few more. They grew by acquisition, right? Intercell is a real interesting company, and I'll take about 2 minutes to describe the Intercell. Intercell is actually a very old name in semiconductors, and back when us guys with gray hair remember Intercell, we remember them as being a rather crummy company. It was sold to, did it go to GE first or RCA first? And whichever one it didn't go to first, it went to second. And then what happened was Harris, now Harris brought, it's just Harris down in Melbourne, Florida. They make transmitters for radios and TVs and stuff like that. They wanted to shed their semiconductor division. So a guy came along and he says, Greg Williams, he says, I know how to do this. We'll take Harris's stuff here. We'll take this Intercell stuff from either GE or RCA, whoever it was, and we'll just come together an Intercell holding company. And they made some nice profits. They actually they bought a guy's company I knew that invented Wi-Fi. Believe it or not, Wi-Fi 802.11 was invented in Kansas City, you know, the heart of technology in the world. And he bought that, and Wi-Fi was really cool, and it grew. And they said, well, gosh, the profits are going away from Wi-Fi. The operating profits they're making from that were about 5%, and this other time they're making 20% on the rest of their stuff. So they sold that, and it is now with Conexant. And then they bought Elantec, who makes some of the best high-speed amplifiers out there. If you buy a DVD player, DVD 16X DVD RW, you've bought an Intercell part. They've got virtually 100% market share in that laser driver there. They do a bunch of neat things. Yes, they did. And they also bought Zycor, another company I really kind of liked. I wrote in my newsletter 3 months before that was announced that Intercell was going to buy them. They got away buying them a little bit cheaper than I thought, but it was because Intercell needed them and Zycor needed them, and now it's a real neat deal. They're doing very well. So, yes, acquisitions.
So, do you know their valuation and that kind of thing?
Do I know their valuation today?
Yeah. How are they selling? What's their market cap?
Their market cap would be, about 130 million shares times, when I left my room, $20.47. So, run those numbers. Intercell right now, in this next quarter they report, I'm predicting they'll report 20% operating profit margin. And I'm predicting that their operational elegance, which is one of my proprietary factors, that takes gross profit dollars, divides it by operating expenses, which I like to call operating investments, is going to drive up to about $2 here sometime next year. And if you look out further, and I love to say that split adjusted, I believe that they're going to produce about $2 per share in fully diluted profits, 2007-2008. Oh, yes. Hi, Russell.
Describing is a very different environment going forward than we've had the last 15 years. That implies to us very different ways of winning. And rather than talking about who you think might win, I think it'd be very interesting to talk about what are the different ways to win, and by winning, we need to not only capture market share, but of course, most importantly, increase shareholder value.
Russell, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the end of that.
How to increase shareholder value?
New ways to increase shareholder value.
Yeah, environment. It's a very different environment. What are the changes in business models or operating methods that will cause us to look back, you know, two or three or five telecosms from now and say, what, that company really did the job. Look at how they changed not only their operating elegance, but their P-E ratio.
Oh, I see. Well, I think that as volatility of the cycle decreases and the cycles happen less frequently, that you inherently get a higher P-E ratio for that. Now, that fights against growth, but certain companies are going to grow at tremendous rates. Surf Technologies, I predicted that they would grow their operating profits by 115% from Q1 of 2005 to Q1 of 2006. Unfortunately, because I didn't have enough time to buy enough stock in Surf, they almost hit that goal sequentially. They had roughly a 100% increase in pro forma operating profits quarter to quarter. So there's going to be these companies that grow, so they're going to get the P-E ratio for growth. And then the sector as a whole, I think, is going to be awarded a better P-E ratio because it's less volatile, more predictable. Linear Tech is a great testament to that. You look at Linear Tech's P-E ratio, and some people might say, well, it's awfully high. Well, Linear Tech produces gross margin of just under 80% and operating margin of, 50-ish? Okay. Your net profit's about 40, isn't it? Yeah, the net profit after tax is about 40%. But they do this very reliably. And that's why people love Linear Tech, and they say, just buy and hold Linear Tech. Now, I'm not saying that is the right thing to do. I'm just saying they're a great example of why dependability of earnings, of fighting the cycle, of not being quite so cyclical, is an important aspect and why that gets you a higher PE ratio.
Thank you, Paul McWilliams.
Thank you.
We can all welcome Nick Tredenick, editor, Gilded Technology Report.
Transistors individually.
start off at a higher cost for a smaller transistor, eventually those costs, when you produce more and more of them, become cheaper, and there's a crossover point at which it becomes cheaper to make 180-nanometer transistors than 370-nanometer transistors. And that crossover point here is at about 5,000 chips. Now, the thing that's important about this is that it gets more expensive to do that 90-nanometer plant, and what happens is that crossover point moves out. So if we look at the crossover point between 90 nanometers and 180 nanometers, it's at about 250,000 chips. And that point is moving rapidly to the right. What that means is that you need bigger markets for newer processes to make it cost-effective to make that investment. The second thing I want to point out about this chart is that notice when we went from 370 nanometers, if we built 5 million chips at 370 nanometers, it cost us about $40 a chip, because now the cost of the plant has been amortized over 5 million chips. If we build that same thing in 180 nanometer, the asymptote is about, looks like, I don't know, $12 or $13. If we build it in 90 nanometers, now we're at 5 million chips, we're down to maybe $8. So the important thing here is that notice that our cost in absolute dollars going from one process to the next dropped by $30 roughly a long time ago. As we get to more newer and newer processes, the absolute value of that decrease is decreasing. So the advantage in going from 180 nanometers to 90 nanometers is only a few dollars, $3 or $4. So in absolute dollars, it's a lot less. And as a percentage of the total cost, it's a lot less. So the economic incentive to go to smaller transistors is decreasing. All right, let's talk about microprocessors. The third area here on my chart for what I call the killer app chart here was the introduction of the microprocessor in about 1971. And what that did was that started a 30-year stall in logic innovation, because the microprocessor was such a great way to solve problems that it became a universally accepted way to build circuits. Let's design our products with a microprocessor. As long as the performance is good enough, that's all we need. And so starting in 1971, microprocessors were the basis of all design, and programming became problem solving. So we stopped knowing how to do logic design. All right, so let's talk about ASICs and versus microprocessors. They're really, I view it as two different worlds out there. There's a group of logic designers, and those are the nerds that know how to do logic equations and build things out of gates. And then there are programmers, the guys that know how to solve problems using computer languages. And the group of programmers is about 10 times the size of the group of logic designers. So if you can solve a problem with programmers, they're probably a better deal because they're probably cheaper than logic designers, and there are more of them, so you can solve more problems total that way also. So if you want the ultimate in flexibility, though, you want to use programmers. If you want the ultimate in performance, you build what's called an application-specific integrated circuit, and that has to be done by logic designers. So I divide the field into those two different groups. And the market for ASICs, and these numbers are probably a little old, but this is my view of the market. On one axis, you have performance. On another, you have problem size. You can solve about the same size problem either way, although I guess some people would say you could solve infinite size problems with a program because, well, in fact, you know, there's, I guess Microsoft is proving that you can write infinite size software. But anyways, there's performance on one axis. If you want the most performance, you build an application-specific integrated circuit. That's about a $30 billion market. Microprocessor market's about $40 billion. Over time, as microprocessors get better, they eat into that ASIC market. So what's happening today is that the microprocessors are invading that ASIC market. Well, let's look at what the computer market looks like. And so here's a bar graph of the computer market. And as you can see from this bar graph, and again, the numbers may be a little old here, but there's like 180 million microprocessors proprietary architectures from, like Spark, PowerPC, x86 again, and Itanium, and talk about that, you know, 1 square mile of silicon. That's, I think, what the next Itanium is planned for. So a lot of what you see in the press is talking about that little server patch down there. I'm not even going to discuss supercomputers because I was just being generous to give them enough ink that you could see it on the chart. So it's not really relevant to the market. But we could talk about who's going to win what market share. You know, what's the importance of Apple going to x86, for example? Unfortunately, there's no time to do that. Let's talk about microprocessors in general, though. Because yesterday in one of the talks, we heard that somebody saying, hey, there are going to be trillions of processors out there. And I agree, that's probably right. And they're all going to be talking to each other. And then, of course, unless we make better progress than even Kurzweil predicts, then they won't be talking to each other over a Windows interface. Because they just won't be smart enough. But if you look at what happens to that chart, and the reason that I didn't put embedded processors on the last chart was that it makes the PC market look like a floor tile. So already we've got, maybe 8 billion processors a year being shipped into embedded applications. Now here I include in the embedded set, I included things like cell phones and so on. And in this set we have ARM and ARC, and we have x86, of course. We have everybody in this one, right? This is, in fact, other fits in this category, which is probably 50 or 100 different kinds of processors. And then the PC and server market are still on there. And we'll talk about who's going to win that. Talk about microprocessor design here and why microprocessors are a problem. You know, I said there's a 30-year stall that was introduced by the introduction of the microprocessor. That's because what we do in microprocessor design is a flawed process that ends up with an inefficient product. And so we can't solve problems efficiently with microprocessors, which means it's not the right way to solve problems for mobile devices. And so what the reason there's a problem is that the user's manual is the bridge between the programmers and the logic designers. So the programmers look at the user's manual and they go, hey, here's some instructions that work pretty well. I'll concentrate on using those to solve my problem. And the logic designers are sitting over there measuring what instructions the programmers use to solve the problems, and they try to make those better. So nobody's actually building processors that make the problem solving better or more efficient. Gosh, I'm not going to have time to talk about this, but there are these things called design time configurable processors. Let me just skip forward a couple of slides, and I'll try to talk. Yeah. Yeah, read about it if I ever write the newsletter that describes this. Huh? I did? Oh, so I should go back and read my own newsletters. So what the microprocessor guys are trying to do is solve bigger problems with programmers. What the ASIC guys are trying to do, and you can see it right here, that there are companies like ARC and MIPS and Tensilica that are letting you modify the processor a little bit to try to do better, but that requires a logic designer. There's a very interesting company called Stretch that takes a standard microprocessor, combines it with a little programmable logic, and then through a software interface tries to find the bottlenecks in the program, in the application, and build custom logic in that on-chip fabric to make the processor solve the problem more efficiently. And so I think that's a really good thing because we're now up where programmers can use that and you don't need logic designers to solve these problems more efficiently. Let me see if I have, I may have been my last slide. No? Okay, so what those guys are doing is we've got a new thing that I think is configurable microprocessors and maybe runtime configurable, maybe real-time configurable, I don't know. But I think it's going to be a new category that will grow and that will increase the efficiency of being able to steal applications from that ASIC market. Unfortunately, I don't have time to talk about soft-core microprocessors and the FPGA guys and what they're doing, but maybe in the question period we'll have a little time to cover that. So, now it's time for somebody that actually knows what they're talking about. Fred Weber, who's recently fired himself as CTO of AMD, so you can ask him questions about anything.
I see it as consistent, and I really do see a strengthening of ARM. The
One of the most important of those is the emergence, I think, of Windows CE as something that a year or two ago a lot of people were writing off as perhaps a dead branch, and has really made a strong comeback. Initially with huge popularity of this AudioVox cell phone, and just the other day we saw the Trio announcement. That is all revitalizing both the interest in and the effort on Windows CE. The same thing is going on with Linux and other software. So I think that's continuing. I also think this tension in the business model continues, but even here I've been hearing more and more acceptance of my long-term thesis here, which is essentially trying to control, that trying to gain the control through the exclusivity is a rearguard action, and that in the end there'll be more disentanglement, that devices, that consumers will choose their devices separately from their carriers and will choose their content over essentially common carriers. That, I can't tell you if that's a 3-year, a 5-year, or a 20-year result, but it seems that seems to be the long-term trend, and I see some evidence moving that way. All right, now getting back to the deep silicon stuff. Client processors, so the thing that you see in your cell phone, in your mobile computer and so on, the most important thing that I see going on here is a continuing strong trend towards more and more integration, and I would go so far as to say towards full system on a chip, single chip solution. Moore's Law has always been a driver of that. The more transistors you have, the more room you have to just throw on everything. And as we run out of useful things to do with those transistors in some dimensions to get more performance, it becomes sensible to integrate. More importantly, one of the biggest wasters of power is moving signals between chips. It turns out it's a lot harder to move a signal effectively between chips than on a chip. So when you care about power, you tend to see integration. Now, there are subtleties how that's not entirely true, but I'd say that to a first bit, that is sufficiently true that it's driving this SoC. The platformization, the concern, and the fact that the value is in the complete system is true as well and is another issue that drives this SoC direction. One interesting thing to think about that is that it's possible there'll be some, you would think that this SoC direction, and I do believe, leads towards consolidation, leads towards a few players being the only suppliers of the devices, and leads to small companies, as I say below, complementary devices, are more and more just an ingredient within an ingredient. The microprocessor, the heart of the computer, is really just an ingredient in the computer. But the I.O. bus, the graphics, the Wi-Fi, they're an ingredient within an ingredient. And the SoC trend means that you're really becoming a small ingredient. Again, I put down here the fact that ultra-wideband I see as commoditized before it's even commercialized. It's not in the public markets already. It's not available. And there are so many suppliers, it becomes a question of you buy it on the market, not from anyone in particular. However, one kind of interesting trend is to watch things like Microsoft's experience with the first Xbox and the second Xbox, where they've gone from a more buying off-the-shelf parts to more control over the IP that they're putting in there, much like the Sony model in game consoles is full control over the entire stack. And as, let's call him the wise guy yesterday said, more trend towards fully integrated circuits. So I think there's a new emerging tension between the natural direction of winner-take-all, a few companies supplying these SoCs, and the systems companies perhaps re-emerging into fully integrated stacks of software, hardware, and the delivered system. There's very little obvious evidence of this, but if you believe in trends, and I really do, or you believe in cyclical trends in design, a great one in the computer industry is the move from client-server to individual computing, back and forth and back and forth, and you can trace that over and over again, and there are others. This consolidation and specialization is another one that may be going on and may be important. I'm also seeing a very interesting opportunity for innovation in server storage and infrastructure. Now you might again say, who cares? It was a tiny little blip on a tiny little blip on Nick's chart. Nick's chart, however, is unit volume, not dollar volume, and even more importantly, not gross margin. And the chart almost reverses if you do it that way. So there's a lot of gross margin to be made here. The important
that I've seen going on. Last year I talked about in the question and answers that multiprocessing is really going to move along pretty quickly. We're going to see a move from faster and faster uniprocessors to an acceptance finally after 40 years of multiprocessors. Well, it's moving even more quickly than I had expected. Not surprisingly in some sense, when both AMD and Intel both make their entire roadmaps multi-core, you know, it's done. Multiprocessing is a reality for better or for worse. But it really is gaining an acceptance very, very quickly. And you can see AMD and Intel going there. Sun and a startup called Azul really proving that multiprocessing, highly threaded solutions work in many application spaces. And other startups like Cavium and Rosa Microelectronics and others having parts in the market that are showing much more highly threaded solutions than we've seen in the past. That in itself is important, but something that I see coming along with that is when you have a big multiprocessor system, you already have very complex control, and you have very capable processors to do all the usual tasks, kind of your whole body, your brain, and your lungs are all there in this one homogeneous multiprocessor. In that environment, it's much easier than in a single processor system, sort of an old mainframe-ish system. It's much easier to introduce specialized co-processors to answer specialized needs. And here is where I'm finally actually coming around to one of the things that Nick has been pushing for a long time, of reconfigurable computing. I don't believe reconfigurable computing is the answer for general purpose processing, because it's not amenable to essentially time sharing. And that's an incredibly important part of general purpose computing. However, as specialized computing, I think there's some real opportunity here. In particular, there's a lot of things going on about what to add in the environment of these server or storage processors or switching environments to add value. People are talking about enhanced coprocessors, specialized threaded or vector coprocessors using graphics processors to accelerate the problem, and also looking at FPGAs. But the architect in me really thinks about this as essentially the value of the extremes and the problem of the excluded middle. Dominant microprocessors do what they do fabulously, and they're incredibly flexible, and they're software. So they're winners, and that will not go away. All these other things are specialized kind of halfway in between things that are very good when they're domain-specific. The beauty of the FPGA is it solves exactly the problem you have in mind from raw material. When you combine the two, the stuff that's kind of irregular and program-like, let's use a microprocessor. For everything else that's weird and you want to specialize, let's go whole hog and design the hardware for the algorithm. That, I think, may have a tendency to exclude some of these things in the middle and to create a real opportunity for these FPGAs. We'll see over time whether that evolves, but I'm finally starting to get interested in that area. So thanks a lot.
Sort of stating our time budget here, and I'm going to ask Greg Papadopoulos to join us. He's the Sun CTO and Executive Vice President at Sun also. And we didn't give him time to talk because he's going to be speaking later today. So. All right. Anybody have anything interesting from that? Actually, I'm interested in what you're going to do next, Fred.
Yeah, what are you going to do next, Fred?
Here's a guy that just quit what I consider to be the ideal job. You know, it's one of those high-paid, do-nothing jobs. Well, both of you guys have those jobs. There's CTO positions.
Best job in the business.
It is. No, and
I'm looking for the next high-paid, do-nothing job. And if anybody...
No, that's not true. He's not looking for that. There's better reason than that. And I want to know what it is, because I'd be willing to bet that it's a good thing to bet on.
Well, it's interesting. I just got off of 10 years at AMD, and I think it was just a tremendously good experience. We, in a lot of ways, got the opportunity of a lifetime to turn the company around, and Intel made the mistake that I just can't imagine ever seeing something that good again. For me,
I got to a point where there's a roadmap that that is wonderful looking forward, and my interests are in moving into two things. One, there's a lot of, at a more systems level in the consumer electronics space, I think there's a lot of excitement. I'm very interested in the fact that LCD glass can be thought of almost as an analogy to mirrors. You roll out sheets of glass and you put a little bit of chemical on the back of them and you ship it. And if you think of it that way, this is an incredibly important development. There's going to be LCDs everywhere. And it's very important to think about what's going to go on every single one of those LCDs. So I want to spend some time on that. And then on some of these other things that I was talking about at the end, it's, I think, an opportunity where to look at some new things take advantage of what you can do with a smaller engine and a lighter tiller. There's an advantage to a big company with a big engine and a little bit of a heavy tiller. In some of these spaces, I think some of the innovation will come from the startup threat. So
Greg, how are you going to save some?
Internally, it's a really exciting time at the company because we've been investing like crazy for the past 3 or 4 years in things like Niagara, which is some radical multi-threading. We completely blew up our processor roadmap in sort of the face of actually a lot of things that we both identify as well. And I think, you know, partly it's this, a lot of excitement inside the company. We've got this whole string of announcements coming out. We just did, Andy Beckelheim's back and has done some really creative things with Octron. And we're kind of waiting for the external market reception to catch up.
Doesn't going to x86 put you in competition with Dell? I mean, how are you going to... I want to know how do you do the Chrysler thing?
Well, come on. We all saw the ads. They took Dell head on and I think have a very good statement about the value that Sun is adding in the server space with their design of the systems, with Solaris, with the choice of microprocessor. Greg may have to be more politics, but I think they're taking Dell on in the server space and they're... Well,
and with the right microprocessor there too. Now, I think there are lots of things that go into it, and we can get into a bigger discussion. But to react to what to integrate in what you guys are saying is, I think there is a factoring of where does computation actually take place, and certainly the explosion at the edge and all of the consumer electronics that everybody's talking about that drives volume. But there's also a shift to very high volume services. So if you look at a Google or an eBay or what goes with it. And those are different design sensibilities. And we think that we're especially focused and well equipped to help with the edge from a programming abstraction point of view and what does that ecosystem look like, but really on how do you build truly worldwide, global, secure, scalable services, and what does that look like? And I think that the design parameters in there are very different, and the discussions are very different. That's where we're focused. So there are a lot of things, around energy, throughput, et cetera. But can I make one comment kind of combine these together here? The other thing that everybody can touch upon is that everything that gets made is getting networked, so we know that, right? And I think what it means is that every manufacturer of a device will have a continuous relationship with that device, right, and with the consumers. I say behind every interesting device is an even more interesting service. The iPod is really great, sexy. It has great, cheap and technique or whatever it is. But iTunes is even more interesting because of the stickiness of the service and what it means. If you have that, ultimately at the device level, you have to think about delayed binding of functions. It has to be that functionality is updatable and configurable and moldable in this, after the device is sold. So that, I think that's going to inform a lot of the architectural.
So Sun has always seemed like a workstation company, but yet you had this vision that the network is the computer. And so it may be under the covers it's really a services company, and that's what you're going to exploit?
I would tell you the biggest bet we're making in the company is the commoditization of computing. And computing. We already made the big bet on bandwidth, George. That was that's a constant bet of the company. But commoditization of computing, and that's to be distinguished from commoditization of computers. And it is actually a really important next step. But that gets into these questions of, so what is the moral equivalent of a power grid for computing, and what are the engineering principles? Power grid's really interesting because it's going to go under some reinvention right now as it intersects with information technology. But how do you build truly large-scale, global, energy-efficient, secure, all of those predictable, commoditized computing infrastructure? And that's another reason why I think that, sort of the hegemony of things like binary contracts are really important, because they help sort of reduce the switching costs and the friction of moving applications around, and that's essential too. And that may sound really surprising coming from us, but it's a big bet. And if you go bet on it, then you say, what's the engineering you need to do to work at that scale? And I would challenge Dell to go think in that those terms.
And remember, they have been saying consistently, what is it? It's probably 15 years now, the network is the computer. And I think they said it a little too early, but now is when that absolutely is true, absolutely matters, and that company has been on that path forever. And when you commoditize computing, you do it in the context of a network.
So we're willing to take questions anytime somebody, there already are some.
That's
right. So, might wait for
I think we have a microphone.
What is your view on the acquisition of Storage Tech, and what were you thinking when you made that decision?
Along with me.
ROI.
It's the future of the internet. we did acquire Storage Tech. Just completed the acquisition. It's a far bigger story than tape, although I would tell you that I've learned more about magnetic recording in the past 6 months than I ever thought I would have to acquire in my life. But it really is about information lifecycle. And I think that the biggest challenge we have facing the industry and, in fact, the world, say when you talk about metadata, the value really is in data access, its lifecycle, its retrieval, and how you tie that into security models. And Storage Tech, has over a third of the world's data is archived on those systems. And connecting that together with what we've traditionally done very well at Sun around identity management and security and access control. So we're really trying to tie that equation together. The short clip is, I've never met a single customer who's interested in archive or backup.
They call it store with.
Yeah, store with. Well, yeah, that's right. The people are not interested in archive and backup. They're interested in retrieve and restore, right, in that business. And what is the intersection of bandwidth and storage? Store with.
So let's talk about where the opportunities are here and what's specifics about who's going to die and who's not. I think really we'll see the transformation of entire industries, the automotive industry. Electronics is going to invade any industry you can mention, and we really will have trillions of connected devices. But we can't still have 100 different microprocessor architectures. So who's going to win that battle? Is ARM going to take over all the embedded apps? Is x86 going to win the battle?
We can both respond. Fred already has. At a couple of different layers. First of all, let me just say categorically, if silicon and all the trends we talk about and system on chip, silicon today is like what FR4 epoxy fiberglass was 20 years ago. If you can't craft silicon, you basically aren't a computer company. So I'll give you, sort of a separating plane that if you don't have silicon crafting skills, basically you're a reseller in the computer business. So take that as it were. I don't think, you know, there's this sort of instruction sets mattering less and less. I believe that the more deeply embedded the devices become, the less the instruction set architecture matters. Unless we do get a resurgence of something like Windows CE, you know, to go drive a binary standard. But look at the mobile phones. I mean, we have, you know, 750 million Java licenses out there for J2ME, and there are many, many different instruction set architectures that sit on the mobile phones just sufficiently abstracted. We in Sun Labs, we just have a Java virtual machine that runs in 50 kilobytes now, which is a self-bootstrapping thing. We think that will erase over a lot of the differences in ISAs and actually allow people to get to abstractions where I can do this sort of hyper-specialization and not worry about a binary contract. That being said, and I'll say something that, you know, I'll say it to here in this kind of conference because it's controversial. I think actually mostly, unless you're x86, an instruction set architecture that's different from that is value subtract. It's not, there's nothing that is intrinsic about an instruction set architecture that's desirable or differentiable.
Well, I like Fred's model there, that it's like having different kinds of money and you always have that exchange cost.
And by the way, I agree with Greg that it sounds like a contradictory to say at the same time instruction sets matter less and matter more, but it's absolutely true. Where the instruction set matters, you're moving towards monoculture more and more rapidly all the time, and there are more and more places where it doesn't matter, and there are places, as I said, with this heterogeneous multiprocessing, where it simultaneously matters and doesn't matter. It says that you have to think carefully about what you're trying to accomplish, and a general purpose new instruction set or legacy instruction set is, I agree with Greg, is value subtract, not value add. That doesn't mean it's useless. It doesn't mean it doesn't have applications. It doesn't mean it goes away overnight. Because you don't throw away an old asset. A depreciated asset is still a valuable asset, even if used appropriately.
So now I agree general-purpose microprocessor, at least the core, will be in all these trillions of devices that communicate. But one of the things that fits in the middle of that graph, you showed it in your last slide, is digital signal processors. So what do you think about, I mean, should we all short TI?
Well, that's been a very good company. There's a lot to be said for what DSPs did. First of all, there's always the tension of moving some of the DSP capability into the microprocessor, and that hasn't happened as well as it can happen in the future.
But it is happening.
But it is happening, and I think it's going to accelerate. And at the same time, you've got the FPGA on the other side. So I don't think it's the richest space for growth. I think it's the long-term sense of the value of the DSP as an architecture, I think, is going down. Now, you build up an installed base, a history, and an ability to move forward, and I wouldn't want to be the guy predicting the death of the DSP.
Somebody wrote a paper about that 5 years ago.
However, predicting that the megatrend more favors against accelerated growth there, I think I do feel reasonably comfortable about that.
I think it's maybe going almost on 20 years that if you come up with a processor architecture that's really focused on sort of how much throughput you can get and how much computing you can do without any attention to the programmability of the part, you call it a DSP. And sort of stands for destroy software productivity. I wouldn't want to predict the demise of the DSP. One thing is that it certainly plays this incredibly important role in the late binding, I think. And I'll have a lot more to say in my talk about sort of the role that codecs and implementation transcoding is playing.
Do we have any other questions? Oh, we do.
Yeah, right over here. I'm John Dome. My question is that it's an analog to telecosm conference and Sun focus. In a lot of ways, George won, right? The telecosm is happening. It was predicted and it's happening. Sun, in a lot of ways, with a networking computer, it won. And my read on both things is now we're kind of in this sort of rudderless discovery mode. You know, when Scott was here talking about Java, I asked this question, I don't get it. You guys are trying to differentiate or
commoditize your hardware platform, yet you've got no substitute revenue stream. And, you know, here at the conference, you know, we're talking about power and storage and nano and singularity and tail and all these other different things. What I'd like to understand exactly is what's the real Sun point of view and what's the fundamental basis for that point of view that's going to sustain some kind of perspective supporting this commoditized computing perspective that you promulgated today?
Wow, I'm glad that's a question for you.
I can only say it. I don't want to turn this into, you know, a Sun investment discussion or something. It's a much more fun conference than that. I think that at the root of taking commoditization is really the big bet that we're placing. And why do we like the commoditization of computing? Is you think about commodities are good things, right? They are have a sort of transparent, you know, continuous global demand that has some sort of characterizable price elasticity to it. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why that is a really good thing for the computing business. There are all these numbers around in semiconductors. There are $2.5 trillion spent every year by the world on information communication technology. We, you know, in the focus of sort of the physics side of the world here, are only getting a very small piece of that $2.5 trillion. There's a lot of inefficiencies in there. There's, you know, a lot of things that need to change. The question is, when you see commoditized markets, what's the level of engineering and technology differentiation that goes into it? So oil is the commodity, but go look at the amount of technology that a BP or a Shell or a Mobil Exxon goes and puts into, you know, everything from discovery down to production to refining and distribution. They're very intensive businesses. I feel like now in the computing business, we're kind of like where a power generation was turn of the century, last century, you know, 1800s to 1900s. And we kind of got ourselves convinced that we perfected the generator that can power, you know, a small office, so a Honda generator or something. And we figured now we have to go build the grid, the power grid. And so everybody's mind is we're going to take thousands of these, you know, Honda generators and stack them up and kind of make the grid out of it. And it's just not the way it's going to happen. I mean, there's really going to be some interesting solid engineering that goes into that. So we would probably liken ourselves more like how you see GE in the, you know, the big equipment business. By the way, if you apply my wave theory I was talking about earlier, we've been in a trend of the value of commoditization and short channel and cheap and things like that. And I think what Greg's saying is something that I believe deeply in. There's a few companies, the Sun being a leader there, IBM as well, where if now that all those things are out there in such volume and everybody can figure out how to shorten the supply chain and supply them a little cheaper, and they may have to re-engineer to get there, it's likely that we will go back into a systems engineering requirement to make this stuff valuable. And the companies that have a deep historical capability there and have managed to preserve it, and not all of them have preserved it, will be advantaged. And the GE analogy is interesting because, you know, GE is a finance company with deep insight into many, many industries, and that has benefited greatly. I mean, and Fred and I will have these, I won't say what our side conversations were, but we get into things to talk about, you know, well, how does a particular idea apply to a 1,000 scale, you know, CPU system or, you know, multi-terabytes of DRAM, and have those kinds of discussions. That's systems engineering at large. It's less about what does a particular component look like and how are they assembled.
So let's take probably one more and then we're out of time.
Jamie Kotika, on multi-core processing, in your mind, will multi-core processing and companies be subject to the same sort of cyclical trivialities that that Nick had shown and Paul had shown in his charts, or is it revolutionary enough or evolutionary enough to avoid some of the pitfalls?
So I hope Paul is right in what he said, that the amount of memory
equates with the volatility and the returns in a negative way, because multi-core processors are not that way at all. I see the multi-core processors as really very much in a line with innovation in processors. The processor business gets stuck. I disagree with you. It's not 40 years of nothing. It's been huge progress here and there.
30 years
of nothing. But it gets into rust. And it got into a rut, and the multi-core is the next thing that pops it out of the rut. And there are some good reasons to believe in less cyclicality that Paul said, and I agree with those, and they apply to microprocessors, but there's no magic in the multiprocessor, as far as I can see, that further changes what Paul said.
Let me give a little more color on that. I think that what you're seeing with multi-core is systems on a chip, and it's been predicted to go into the general purpose arena like this because there's been about a decade of system on chip in the more deeply embedded specialized area, just like there was a decade of microcontrollers from 71 through the early 80s until the microprocessor and the sensibilities of general purpose processor design. I think we're just seeing that what I said before, systems were rendered on epoxy fiberglass circuit boards was the canvas. Now systems are rendered on chips. That's the canvas, and that's what multi-core is really representing. The great innovation in my mind of Opteron was, the memory controller and the processor and the hypertransport, all taking from the microprocessor's point of view, we're designing the system, and we're rendering that system in microelectronics, period.
To the extent that that's true, and I tend to agree that that's true, it will favor companies with systems capability, whether they're systems companies like Sun and IBM, or silicon companies with a strong systems orientation, and disfavor essentially screwdriver shops who don't bring that integration. They become less valuable as the integration becomes important. Just a little plug for my alma mater, AMD. It's kind of interesting, as I sat inside of AMD and saw the big talk about platformization coming out of Intel, there's a lot of ways in which, if you look at the people who are inside of AMD and who are running it, they all came from a very strong systems background, from the systems company, whether Digital Equipment Corporation or my own history in startups that built computers and mainframes and supercomputers. Thinking of the problem from the computer in rather than from the chip out has been deeply ingrained there, and I think that's why, as this chip conversion is coming, or as this change is coming, AMD was so well positioned. And a little bit, I think, Intel's own history did catch up with it, where they had been a chip company, and the chip was the thing for so long.
What I call the cost of culture. And, of course, the ultimate end point there is this multi-trillion unit interconnected heterogeneous processor. Okay,